BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is where leading experts are warmly welcomed, then handed the task of explaining the nuts and bolts, the rhyme and sometimes reason of the day's most pressing issues. This week, there's a new PM, but an old but fundamental problem. Why is British economic growth so low? And what should be done about it? The new Prime Minister has told us that her number one objective is to promote economic growth. As it happens, that's also what the Leader of the Opposition wants. But growth is low, and the problem of growth is long-term. So why are we performing so badly, and what needs to be done to turn us into a high-growth country? Step into the briefing room to find out. First, for a short history of post-war British economic growth, the Briefing Room's Paul Connolly has been speaking with Nicholas Crafts, Professor of Economic History at the University of Sussex Business School.
We begin in the 1950s. By now, we've left the hardships of the immediate post-war period behind, and things are looking up.
Austin, MG, Triumph, Mini, Jaguar, Daimler, Princess, Morris, Rover.
In the 1950s and 1960s, we have a phase of very strong economic growth, productivity growth. In the UK, for example, labour productivity grew at nearly 4% a year, about 3.9% in fact, which is the highest in our economic history.
The growth of productivity, as in how much we produce per unit, such as per hour worked, is, by the way, closely linked to economic growth. The two go hand in hand.
It is a period where I think business is pretty optimistic, and we see a high investment rate in the economy as well. So it's better technology in a variety of fields, together with investment, which helps us to exploit the technology.
Back then, what's called technology transfer, in this case, buying in the best America had to offer, helped to create a brave new world of possibilities.
Think about the sort of motor car factory of the 1950s or 60s compared with what you would have seen round about the time of the First World War. It's rather a different beast. This period is often known as the golden age of European growth. Although inflation eventually came to be a problem, that wasn't until the 1970s.
The era of cheap petrol is over. Today, for £1, the petrol that goes into your tank is little more than 1.5 gallons.
In 1973, oil prices suddenly go up fourfold. And those higher energy costs then lead to price hikes everywhere else, which, for all of us, of course, will sound painfully familiar. Inflation peaks at 24% in 1975, and growth slows to an acrimonious crawl.
The policymakers appear rather startled and unsure what to do. Business loses confidence. Industrial relations become absolutely terrible. Most famously, in the winter of discontent, so-called, 1978-9, when in the most notorious strike, the gravediggers in Liverpool refused to bury bodies. And that was the prelude to Mrs. Thatcher being elected in the spring of 1979.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony. Where there is error, may we bring truth.
Mrs. Thatcher had a quite mixed impact on growth.
On the one hand, the professor says, Thatcher pushed through new policies that improved efficiency and through that raised productivity and thereby economic growth. But on the other hand, he tells me that Thatcher's government went on to have a very damaging effect on our labour productivity in the longer term. Take the notorious public spending cuts.
The way in which the Thatcher government set about, as they saw it, restoring public finances, made a really dramatic cut in infrastructure investment as part of that. And we've never probably really recovered from that. Subsequent governments didn't restore what Thatcher had cut away.
I've just accepted Her Majesty the Queen's kind offer to form a new administration of government in this country.
In 1997, New Labour gained power under Tony Blair. Now, this was the era of the long boom where economies across the world were growing. Here, in the main, the growth-focused reforms made by Thatcher stuck. They were unchanged. But trouble of seismic proportions was brewing just beneath the surface. Deregulation of the financial markets back in 1986 had led to a boom in the financial sector. Banks were allowed to take much, much higher risks, including with mortgages. This set in motion something of a delayed domino effect.
And in 2007-08, putting it in cliched fashion, those chickens came home to roost.
Financial institutions around the world are bracing themselves for the collapse of the American investment bank Lehman Brothers.
The immediate impact of the financial crisis was a major recession. So we see GDP falling by 5-6%.
The economy did start to grow again relatively soon, but the impact on productivity was long-lasting.
The average for the period 2007-19 is productivity growth of about 0.4% a year. I don't think there's a single year, even in the recovery period, where productivity growth is as big as 1% a year. We don't get back to the pre-2007 productivity performance. And this period is still known in the literature as the productivity puzzle.
We do, however, have some clues for that puzzle. One being the austerity programme introduced by the Conservative-led coalition government that came to power in 2010. The problem with austerity, says Professor Crafts, is...
The easy thing to cut is public investment. Various other things were cut, public services, which probably affect productivity as well. But, you know, we're not building the new power stations, we're not building the reformed railway, whatever it might be.
And then came the COVID pandemic with, of course, its widespread business closures and an estimated 10% fall in GDP in 2020.
In the longer term, what will COVID do? Here, the waters have now become hugely muddied by the fact that we've got the new crisis to deal with, the stagflationary shock of the 2020s, the cost of living crisis.
Which brings us to today, now. As it stands, economic growth in the UK is, well, it's sluggish. The most recent figures available are for the 3 months of April to June of this year. If they were replicated for a year, then our current annual GDP would fall by 0.3% and we'd be in recession. But the new PM, Liz Truss, is targeting an average growth rate of 2.5% per annum. Now, is that achievable? Can we grow as we did after the lockdowns of 2020 ended? Or will the cost of living crisis make that nigh on impossible?
The Briefing Room's Paul Connolly there, along with Professor Nicholas Crafts. So, that's the background. What about now? Where does Britain stand in comparison to other similar countries? My next guest is Chris Giles, the economics editor for the Financial Times. So, Chris Giles, let's look at comparable economies to Britain's. When it comes to growth, who's been doing well?
Well, I think the most important thing you can say right at the moment is since the financial crisis of 2008-2009, no advanced economy has been doing really well. But some people and some countries have done better than the UK, and quite a lot have done significantly better over that whole period from about 2008 to 2022. So it would be including some of the large European economies, Germany, France, not Italy, very much not Italy, definitely the US, and then some of the smaller advanced economies, so the Nordic countries, Netherlands, etc. Those countries have been doing better than us over that long period.
Roughly how much better?
Not a huge amount. So we're talking about per year, if you think about GDP per head, so the amount of money that's generated in an economy per person, less than 0.5% per year. Over time, 0.2, 0.3% can actually turn out to be something that you feel noticeably different for British people if you're not at the top end of the income distribution, because rich people in the UK are richer than rich people in Germany and France, but middle and lower income people are significantly worse off.
Right, well, let's look at the countries that have performed particularly well. Germany is always put near the top of the list. Can you pinpoint the primary reasons why you think Germany continues to outperform us?
Well, I think we should first of all say what I don't think it is. And lots of people would say, look at Germany, it's their industry, that's what makes them successful. Remember, German industry is much bigger than UK industry, but it's still only 20% of the German economy. It's not the whole German economy. So you've got to look at much more broadly than that. And I think the broad reason is they do better for middle-skilled and lower-middle-skilled people, so they are more productive at that sort of level, both in industry and in services. Just think about, you know, the very successful German supermarkets, Audi and Lidl. They're not just good at building cars, they're good at quite a lot of other things.
You've mentioned the French also as an economy that's doing better than us. So what are they doing differently?
France and the UK are very similar, and we often like to think we're very different from the French, but actually we're remarkably similar. Our economy structures are very similar. And the big difference with France is its productivity performance, which has been stronger than ours. Its labour market performance, getting people into jobs, is worse than ours. But for those people in work, they've managed to increase the value of what they're producing every year faster than we have in recent years. But it goes back quite a long way. So this goes back to our productivity problem, which is particularly, again, the sort of middle-skilled, middle-paid people in the UK. We have very good top-end companies, absolutely world-class. They're no worse than top-end companies in France or Germany or the US. But we have a long, long tail of less successful companies.
Do we have to make a distinction between the amount that they work and what they have to work with?
Yes, we tend to work quite a lot in the UK. So a lot of hours are worked in the UK. And that's one of the ways that we keep our income levels basically the same as France. So we do more work to have the same amount of income as the French, and they do less work. And that's a choice. They could become richer than us if they worked as many hours as we do.
What can we say about a country like Sweden?
Well, I think Sweden's really interesting. You can sometimes hear, particularly from the right of the political spectrum, that the key thing you need for growth is low taxes. Well, Sweden's a very successful economy. Over half of its economy is taxed away. So that is a lot. They pay a lot of tax. And they just have a very different structure. So they have a structure which is very flexible, so you can be fired very easily in Sweden. But equally, the state will step in and ensure that you personally do not suffer very many hardships if that happens. You can find another job, you will not be destitute. And that has clearly enabled people to take quite a lot of risks and be innovative. That sort of innovation and productivity has been very successful for all of the Nordic countries, and it's a particular Nordic model where it's flexible and a lot of security. Flex security is the horrible word that they like to use.
Let's imagine that I were a new prime minister coming in, but I wanted to start embedding a brand new long-term strategy. Where would I most usefully look, and what would I most usefully do?
The one most useful thing a new prime minister can do is trying to change attitudes, to say that actually growth is something that we really, really need. And so that will mean if someone wants to build something near you, that should happen.
Chris Giles there. We briefly visited the history of growth and taken a comparative look at other countries. Now it's time to look at what determines and what deters economic growth in Britain and what should be done in the long term to secure higher growth. Joining me in the briefing room are Anna Valero, Senior Policy Fellow at the London School of Economics Centre for Economic Performance, Paul Johnson, Director at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and Duncan Weldon, broadcaster and author of 200 Years of Muddling Through. Before we get into the detail here, I was just wondering if we can agree about what the main reasons for low British economic growth and productivity actually are. Paul Johnson, what would you say?
Well, there's been policy failures over a long time. If we look at lack of investment, we look at lack of planning reform, lack of tax reform, and actually more recently, lack of political and macroeconomic stability. One of the things that I think we often don't take enough account of is that something that really matters for growth is actually good politics. And however much fun it may have been to observe what's been happening in British politics over the last 5 or 6 years, international organisations in particular are not keen on investing in countries which don't look particularly stable and where there's a lot of uncertainty about where policy may be going.
Anna Valero.
Well, I think there are a number of policy failures that explain this underinvestment, but fundamentally it's the underinvestment in innovation, skills and infrastructure that drive our poor productivity performance. So this is thinking about research and development, money being spent on developing new technologies, new processes. In some sense, our management practices, something that really matters for productivity, they tend to lag other countries.
And Duncan, what are the attributes you would give to our failures?
Well, a real big problem in Britain has been comparative underinvestment. You know, underinvestment in new capital, underinvestment in infrastructure, underinvestment in skills. And we do appear to be an outlier on that compared to many other, international advanced economy peers. And just to pick up on what was said there, you know, when I speak to firms time and time again, when you ask them, why are you not investing? It's this question of political and macroeconomic stability which comes up.
Okay. Now, Paul Johnson, in broad terms, a lot of these seem to me to be the same problems people were discussing 40 years ago when I was first a very, very young journalist indeed. So why haven't we successfully addressed them?
Well, partly there's a big political problem. I mean, there's a sort of dirty secret, I think, in Whitehall, which is actually they kind of know what to do, but decide not to. So, for example, planning reform. Actually really important that we are able to build things where they are economically valuable, whether that be new houses or roads or factories or what have you. And we decide not to. And indeed, when the Conservatives lost a by-election earlier this year, they scrapped a policy which may actually have been quite good for growth and productivity, which was to liberalise the planning rules. So it's partly the politicians' fault. Again, if you look at investment in education, we are still spending no more educating each of our children at school today than we were 12 years ago. We're spending 40% more on the health service. So we've made some big political choices actually to do things or not to do things, which we know would have been good for growth, but we've decided politically and as a country and as a group of voters not to do them.
Let's look at the problem areas and their solutions in a bit more detail. Now, one we haven't talked about so far has been the tax regime. Anna Valero, has our tax regime been an inhibition to growth? Has it been too high?
Well, I think actually, if you look at the recent years since the onset of the financial crisis, what we saw was a period of corporation tax, for example, the main rate of corporation tax, steadily coming down to actually a very low rate relative to other countries. However, while business investment picked up for a while, it was still low by international standards and it suffered again since the EU referendum. So clearly, if it was as simple as lower taxes, that hasn't borne out. But theoretically, obviously, a favourable tax regime should attract companies and attract investment. The problem is this uncertainty. You're unlikely to make investments if you don't know what the future return on those investments look like.
OK, now, the new PM has also talked about supply side reform. Get the supply side right and you create some of the conditions for growth. And a lot of people listen to that and think, what does she mean? So what does that mean?
Well, supply side is anything that affects the productive capacity of the economy. And broadly, we think of different types of supply side policies. So there are the more free market type of supply side policies, which my understanding is that Truss has been favouring so far. Things like tax cuts, deregulation, for example. Then there's more interventionist supply side policies where the government recognises that there are market failures that need to be overcome and therefore tries to help firms via tax, incentives, via subsidies, via public sector investment as well. And key examples where this is the case are where you have externalities or spillovers. So an investment in something actually benefits the broader society, not just the firm that makes the investment.
Duncan, one of the elements of this is regulation and deregulation. And the new Prime Minister has also talked about deregulation, unleashing Britain to spark growth. Can you talk me through that briefly and tell me how effective or potentially problematic a significant reliance on deregulation is?
Okay, so the OECD, that's sort of a club of rich economies, it publishes really useful numbers ranking sort of all of the advanced economies by measures of how regulated or deregulated their labour market is, how regulated or deregulated various product markets are. And if you look at where Britain is in those league tables, we are a very deregulated country compared to most other advanced economies. So I really do sort of fear that trying to push that, even lower, You know, when we're already very deregulated, it's going to be hard. I mean, the thing about Thatcherism is it's already happened in Britain. It's really hard to do it again after we had a big deregulation of various markets in the 80s and the 90s.
Paul Johnson, let's try and put some of these things together. Skills is the classic example of something that we've talked about for 40 years and we still haven't done it. Why haven't we done it and how are we going to do it?
Well, I think there are some political difficulties around reforming what we all know is a problem, the incredibly narrow A-level curriculum, which every politician forever just refers to as the gold standard and doesn't want to change. And then you've got other bits which are continually changing. So our vocational education, our support for adult education, which, by the way, has collapsed over the last 10 or 15 years, our support for apprenticeships and so on, changes certainly with every government, at least every decade, so that we never get to a point of stability. So each time we get a new government, we get a new set of policies. And you can't have that because education is something that you have to build up over a long period of time.
Duncan, that affects the skills that workers may or may not have at the point where they find jobs. But what do they meet when they get there in terms of the technology that they have to work with?
Yeah, so, you know, for the last 10 years or so, it's been very easy to write a book or an article worrying about robots taking our jobs. You know, a very common idea that AI is going to replace people writing columns such as yourself, David, in the same way that robots replaced industrial workers. If you look at what's happened in Britain over the last 10 or 15 years, robots haven't been taking our jobs. We have been taking the robots' jobs. To give you a concrete example, think about car washers. Your parliamentary report found that in the 15 years until 2018, the number of what they call automatic roller machines, you know, those things you see on a petrol station forecourt, fell by half. While the number of hand car washers, a few generally low-paid men with a bucket and a sponge, soared. By 2018, 80% of the car washers in Britain had ceased being a machine, had started being, you know, your classic ultra low productivity, low wage, low skill people washing a car with a bucket.
So, Paul Johnson, on average, productivity is 20% higher in terms of output per hour in France and Germany. Are the factors that we've talked about, in your view, the main reason why that's the case?
Yeah, and it's worth being clear that 15 years ago, that gap was much, much smaller. It's really opened up since the financial crisis. I mean, partly because the financial crisis hit the UK harder because we have more of a financial services industry, and partly because a series of changes since then, particular underinvestment from both public and private sectors. So all of those things have come together to result in this big gap between the UK and many other European countries, which we see in the first time, essentially since the Industrial Revolution, in which we've had more than a decade without any increase in real earnings. So this really matters for all of our living standards. It's not just an economic concept. Lack of productivity growth goes through into lack of earnings growth, lack of growth in real incomes, and it is down to the whole series of things that we've talked about.
Duncan, let's talk a bit about the business environment and the trading environment. And the elephant in the room here is Brexit. I think we need to understand how big an obstacle our current set of arrangements with Europe in terms of trade are now to growth.
So the cost of Brexit has really come in two different ways. Firstly, from that referendum in 2016 until we got the final deal in place, we had 3 or 4 years of uncertainty. Since then, though, what we've done is we've taken what was previously a frictionless trading border with our largest and nearest trading partner, and we've inserted friction into it. And, you know, if you put friction into a trading relationship, there will be less trade. And what this has meant is it's been harder for British exporters. So British exporters have recovered from the pandemic at a slower pace than many of our global peers. And it's been tough for firms which import goods for consumers in Britain. So this is a real economic cost. Economists tend to put it at something like 3 or 4 percentage points of GDP in the long run.
Paul Johnson, in that famous and horrible phrase, we are where we are. But that doesn't mean we don't have choices. And one of the choices that has been presented to us is essentially to strike out on our own into a far more kind of deregulated world and seek trade, or to get back closer to Europe without going back into the EU. Now, which would be the optimal strategy for higher growth, do you think?
The key point about trade with Europe, it is our biggest, it's our nearest, and it's our richest trading partner. You need to do the most extraordinary amount of additional trade with other parts of the world to make up for even relatively small changes in trade with Europe, because we do so much there. So almost certainly the most effective way, given where we are, is to be as close and as integrated as we can into the European markets.
Anna, what about institutions that can encourage growth? Institutions of the country that can either promote or delay growth?
I think this is a fundamental point, because we actually have weak institutions in this area. And we've also seen a lot of chopping and changing in business and growth policies and strategies. Even within the same government, as business ministers come and go, the entire approach changes.
Should we try and magic up a bipartisan, tripartisan, many partisan commission for growth?
Well, there have been many commissions, some centred in universities and involving policymakers and involving businesses. What we need is actually, I think, the government to create an independent institution that actually has a mandate, that has to provide, say, annual reports, that holds the government to account in the way we have in other areas of economic policy.
Duncan, you were nodding. What do you want to add?
I think that's completely right. I think what I would add is, you know, to try and end on a note of optimism, the fact that countries like France and Germany are 20% or so more productive than us is obviously bad news, but it's also grounds for optimism. It's not like there's something in the water in France and Germany or in Britain which makes us, you know, we have to be less productive. The fact there is a gap suggests that gap can be closed, and there is the room there to seriously grow Britain's productivity with the right policies.
Now, Paul, tell me the bad news.
Right now, we're facing a set of challenges that we haven't faced in a very long time. Inflation clearly extremely high, which makes it a difficult moment to be for government to be investing significant extra money. We've spent hundreds of billions on COVID. It looks like we're going to be spending hundreds of billions on bailing out energy bills. We need to do that in the short run. But whilst we're facing the short term, really almost existential crises, the capacity for government to really focus on the long term is really hard. And of course, we've now only got 2 years left for this government. And everything we've been talking about here is about the long term. And political mindsets are not necessarily focused on that. It is not possible to make a sustainable change to the rate of growth in the economy within 2 years. Governments are genuinely powerful and genuinely capable of making big differences, but it takes a long time. We, the electorate, are often rather keen on things happening a lot more quickly than that. And when you do make things happen quickly, they're generally unsustainable.
Paul Johnson there with Anna Valero and Duncan Weldon. My thanks to Paul Johnson, Chris Giles, Nicholas Crafts, Anna Valero and Duncan Weldon. We'll be back next week. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Kirsty Knight, Arlene Gregorius and Paul Connolly. The studio manager was Neil Churchill and the editor is Richard Varden. If you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. You can tune in to the one about the staffing crisis at the NHS, or there's a programme about drones and what they could mean for the future of warfare.
Hi, Charlotte Williams.
And Amit Katwala here. We are here to tell you about All Consuming, our new podcast series from BBC Radio 4.
Where we'll be exploring our culture of consumption through products that have changed the world.
In each episode, we'll be looking back at the weird and wonderful history of an everyday product and unravelling the formidable forces that drive our purchasing habits.
We're looking at everything from vinyl...
It made you appreciate the music more.
...toilet paper...
And there's not a lot of panic going on, it's actually quite rational.
...and fragrances.
Our capability of being manipulated when it comes to scent is tremendous.
All that and a lot more.
So join us for All Consuming, a new series from Radio 4, available on BBC Sounds.
We hope to see you there.
Bye.